Pierre, again, Pierre's aware of Pierre's work. He's first author on the Civil Tools Guide for, basically for transcriptomic analysis for SNP calling as well as RNA-seq. And as it was, so we share a lineage. We're both postdocs in the Steve Palomi's lab. And for those of us who were working back when PCR was just coming into the fore, the Simple Fool's Guide for PCR came out of the Palomi lab and was, I thought, made PCR very much more accessible. And I loved how Pierre made the protocol, the pipeline descriptions very accessible. You could argue that they were too accessible, that it makes it, you know, sort of too simple, and maybe we will argue about that. But I think it makes it accessible, it gets you in the door. So
I hope we will argue about that.
I'm happy that you are here, and here's Pierre.
Thank you. Thank you. So I'm here to talk a little bit about using transcriptomes for population genomics, which is what I've been doing for the past few years. And I was hoping to convince you that it's a really good first tool when you're working with a non-model organism, such as Matt defined it. Now I kind of feel like I don't have to do that because Andy and Matt already did a really good job at that. So I'll try to point out some of the good things about it and also some of the bad things about it. So we'll try to get a balance there. But first, I want to show you just what I'm planning to talk about. I'm going to just really quickly talk about what RNA sequencing is and then how to analyze that type of data. And that's something that we're going to do later on today and tomorrow as well, work through an example data set using sort of a dumbed down protocol and using genotype thresholds to call genotypes, but just as one example of how you can analyze this type of data and how to use the software that's involved. And then I want to talk about two case studies, the things that we've been doing in our lab, both to look at gene expression changes and also to look at changes in allele frequencies over a transcriptome using basically the same methods, but to answer two very, very different questions. So first, what is RNA sequencing? Well, as Matt said, it's a reduced representation strategy, and it's basically sequencing only mature mRNAs. So it's taking mRNA that's been processed. Let's see where the pointer is. That's been processed. So in case you're unfamiliar with this, your gene is being transcribed in the nucleus to an mRNA. Exons are being spliced out. And at the end, you add this 5' cap and a poly A tail. And then you have a mature mRNA. What the sample prep does is to select for these mRNAs by using these poly T beads and then wash out everything else and then shear the mRNA, convert it to complementary DNA, which is double-stranded and thus more stable, and then add sequencing adapters to both ends of this complementary DNA strand, do a quick PCR step, and then basically sequence all of those small fragments in parallel. So that was just real quick. Why would you want to do this? Well, as we've heard, assembly of genomes is still pretty complicated. It's hard. There's repeat regions. In a lot of the organisms that we work with, there's a lot of polymorphisms that complicate assembly. And then it's also complicated to find which regions have functions in the genome once you have an assembly. So before I move on, I just wanted to show you, I kind of gotten involved in this genome project when I moved to Gothenburg about a year ago. And I don't know how well you can see this. Let's see if I can make it a bit smaller there. And this is something that they have been working on for several years. It's a project to do 8 different genomes of marine organisms. And they've been working on it for about 3 years now, and they've done a lot of sequencing. So if you just look at the top one here, it's a barnacle. They've sequenced about 180 gigabases. And they're 3 different insert sizes, so 150, 300, and 3,000 base inserts. And they have basically a whole staff of bioinformaticians that are trying to put this together. And they're still getting an N50, which is sort of the mean contig length of about 1,500 bases. So just a lot of really short reads. And these are people that know what they're doing, bioinformaticians, and still they get this. You know? So this is complicated. It's not trivial. So that's why we want to focus on just regions of the genome that have reduced complexity. And that goes for any of these different methods that we've heard about today. But in addition, by focusing on only the mRNAs, we also know that all of this material is expressed. So it belongs to a gene, which means that we can get functional information out of it much easier by comparing to other genes with known functions from other organisms. And it also simplifies annotation. So you can actually do compare to other amino acid databases, and you don't have all these deletions and insertions that can complicate annotation as well. And then one really big thing that I think is really the main reason is that RNA-seq, at least in theory, can give you both gene expression profiles and also nucleotide sequence information. So if you have a well-designed experiment, you can actually get both out from the same data. But it's complicated to design it in a good way. So there's a good review here. And I also want to say that all of the references that I have in this talk and throughout these days, I've put on the course website. So you can access them there. And if I've missed something, then please tell me and I'll put it up there. So that's a really big advantage. There are also a lot of disadvantages to using RNA. One is that mRNA is notoriously hard to work with. It degrades extremely quickly, so you have to preserve tissue right away. You have to put it in good buffer solutions or flash freeze it with liquid nitrogen and put it in really cold conditions, or it's going to get ruined. Importantly, I think, is that a lot of the functional information, if you're now interested in finding functional information, a lot of this will not be located in expressed regions, but it will be in functional regions. So it's still a very, very hot debate how much of the functional information is in regulatory regions versus expressed regions. Melody Jones et al. In 2 years ago found in sticklebacks about 41% were located entirely in non-coding regions, and then there was 17% that was in coding regions, and then there was about 40% that were sort of ambiguous. So, but a lot of people I know would argue that this number is skewed because it's also much more difficult to find functionally relevant loci in regulatory regions than it is in expressed regions, just because of the fact that we, in general, have better annotations for expressed regions. So there's still a very hot debate here. And then we have the issue of allele-specific expression that Matt touched upon. And this can bias our genotype estimates. So this was a paper from 2 years ago as well, looking in humans at gene expression. And they found that about 80% of all genes showed allele-specific expression, so that one version of allele is more highly expressed than the other. However, they also saw that almost all of these had less than about 1.5-fold difference between the two. So it would be a sort of 70-30 skewage, which would mean that if you're calling an individual genotype from this, you would still be able to call a heterozygote efficiently. But this could still potentially be a problem. I mean, it needs to be looked at other organisms as well, not just in humans. And also, if you're sequencing pools of individuals to estimate allele frequencies directly, this could also potentially be a problem because it's going to skew your allele frequency estimates. For assembly, particularly when you're looking at RNA-seq data, you have the issue of uneven coverage. So when you're doing genome sequencing, you're basically throwing in a known amount of DNA. You know how large your genome is, and there you just divide basically amount of DNA by genome size, and you know what your coverage is going to be, and it's usually fairly even throughout the genome. With RNA sequencing data, you don't know that. You have highly expressed genes and you have very lowly expressed genes, and there can be several orders of magnitude between these, and that's going to make it hard for assembly software to distinguish between sequencing errors and true polymorphisms in the lowly expressed genes. And then finally, we have these alternative splicing patterns and gene duplications events, which also makes it really hard for the assembly software to put together full-length transcripts accurately. There are some softwares, and we'll use one this afternoon, Trinity, that sort of take alternative splicing into account as well. I think new sequencing techniques have the potential to actually remove this problem by actually allowing us to sequence full-length transcripts completely. So PacBio can do very long reads that can actually sequence whole transcriptomes without having to do any assembly at all. So that's cool for the future, but as has been noted here, we kind of need answers now, so we need to make do with what we have for now. So one really important thing to think about is your experimental design. And with RNA sequencing and with your transcriptomes, you can answer many questions if your design is good. And really, how you design your experiment depends on what question you want to answer. So that's really, when you start with an experiment like this, if you haven't already, that should really be the first thing that pops into your head is, what do I want to answer? And then you design your experiment after that. And it can be very different. For example, how good does my assembly need to be? Does it have to be perfect? Or is it OK if it's crappy and you only get a part of the data out? Like Alex said, you know, you might have to throw 95% out. But if you can still answer your question, then that's still good. And so for gene expression analyses, you need to think about things like common gardening. So in order to compare two different individuals from different populations, say, you really need to have them in the same conditions for a while first in order to compare apples with apples. I'll talk more about that in a second. And if you want to look at nucleotide sequences, you need to take things such as population structure or amino acid sequences into account as well, as Andy talked about with this site frequency spectrum. You need to know if there's any population structure underlying that, or you're going to basically skew your estimates. So for gene expression studies, now if you are interested in doing that, you have to think about this, that gene expression is very, very plastic, both in time and in space. So if you go out and you sample a population here today, and you go out and sample a population over there tomorrow, and then you look at their gene expression, that's not going to work, because they're going to have wildly different gene expression, and you're not going to know why. So you need to put them in the same conditions and then change one parameter. Something that really kind of rattled me a while back was that there's several studies now coming out. This one is in mice. That shows that if you expose pregnant mice with, this is a low protein diet, so it's starvation essentially, that the effects do not only linger to the next generation, but to the next generation after that. So you have, for at least two generations, you have plastic effects of something that you did to the grandparents. And it can even linger even later on. I just saw a study on C. elegans where they exposed them to some toxin, and they saw even a third generation that there were still differences between populations. And those are not nucleotide difference. Those are difference between because of plasticity. So it could be epistatic effects or things like that. So you really need to do long-term transplants if you want to be sure to study adaptation in gene expression and not just look at plastic effects. So if you're interested in separating out adaptation from plastic effects, you need to do it in several generations, which can be a pain. So I'm trying to do a project looking at perch now in the Baltic. And the first thing that was asked of me was like, okay, so how many generations have you had them in tanks now? And I said, well, I'm going to go out and collect them tomorrow. And they have a generation time of 2 years. And, you know, I'm not going to be there for 4 years. So that kind of screws that experiment up. So here's just the basic design of a reciprocal transplant. I'm sure you know already, if you have two populations like this, you take part of one population, you move it over to the other environment, and vice versa, and then you keep them there for quite a while before you start doing any stress experiments or anything like that. Now, if you're interested in looking at nucleotide sequences, which I think most of us are interested in here, so it's population genomics and not transcriptomics class. So if you are interested in that, you need to separate out your adaptive divergence from just potentially adaptive divergence from any population substructure if you're interested in looking at adaptation. And conversely, if you're interested in looking at population subdivision, then it's important to know if your loci are neutral or if they are under selection, right? So, and one key here that I think has been touched upon already is that selection is assumed really to only affect a few loci throughout the genome, whereas population substructure or genetic drift in general is genome-wide. So you can use that to distinguish between those two things. And one way to do it, I'm just going to go through a few ways. One way to do it are these outlier tests that have already been touched upon, where you basically look at the distribution. So here's a graph where you basically have plotted minor allele SNP frequency on the x-axis, and you have FST, or differences between populations, on the y-axis. And you basically have an average throughout the genome or transcriptome and confidence intervals, and then you can find your outliers that are significantly outside of your confidence intervals. And those are potentially can be targets of selection. Or, as Alex said, potentially the entire transcriptome is under balancing selection, and these guys are the only ones that are neutral. So that's also another thing to keep in mind, which I think is really interesting. One way to look at population structure is to do these principal components analyses, where you take all the genetic variation, you reduce it to one point per individual, and you plot it like this. And you basically find that if you have subdivisions, your individuals from different locations will cluster together. Or you can use Bayesian clustering methods, such as structure, that I'm sure a lot of you have used before, where you basically can cluster your individuals, assigning them a population. Then what are the major steps in analyzing this type of data? Well, the first thing you have to do really is to clean up your data when it comes back from a sequencing center. And I'm not going to go through how to do that. We'll do that this afternoon. And then you want to put your data together into an assembly. As we're working with non-model organisms, we're assuming, or I'm assuming, that there's no resource at all available for you guys. You have to do everything from scratch. So you take your reads, your hundreds of millions of reads, and you want to combine them into a transcriptome. And the way you do that really is you look at places where your reads overlap, and then you use that to basically extend consensus length, which will create what's called a contig or a contiguous sequence. So that's a word that we're going to use a lot. If you have a genome available, which you probably don't, you can align your reads to it. And if you don't, then you have to do a de novo assembly. And for that, I think almost all software that's available right now uses this mathematical tool called De Bruijn graphs, which we're going to talk more about that this afternoon. Once you have your transcriptome, you really want to know, that's the advantage of having a transcriptome, is that you can find out what your sequences are, what they do in general. So you want to annotate them. And for our organisms that we work with, non-model organisms, Usually, the only way we can do this is by blasting. So we're basically comparing our sequences to genes from other organisms that are in online databases. And you know, if you tell this to Drosophila people, they're gonna scoff at you and go like, how do you know that it does the same thing in your organism? And you don't, in fact, but a lot of times that this is the best you have, so we have to work with that. Another thing to think about is that blasting in general takes a very long time. It can take up to several minutes per contig, which doesn't sound like a lot, but when you have 100,000 or 200,000 contigs, it's going to take a while. So you really want to have access to some sort of computing resource where you can divide up your jobs in parallel and do it. Then once you have your reference, so basically to create your reference, you pool all of your reads from all the individuals you have, as much data as possible. You get your transcriptome, but then you want to have individual information, right, from each of your individuals. And so what you do is you take your individual data files and you align them or map them. So two words for basically the same thing. And I will use these words sort of interchangeably. I'll try to be consistent and say alignment because I like that word better. And basically what you're doing is, here's a figure where you have your contig up here, and then all of these gray things are your short reads that you basically align to the contig. And the way this works, and we'll look at this more this afternoon, is that it usually the algorithm, it takes a short part of the read first. So it depends on how long your reads are, but usually it takes a short part, maybe 30 bases or so, and it basically tries to find matches throughout the transcriptome. And once it finds a match, then it will try to align the whole thing. And that speeds up the process quite considerably. And so there are several variables to think about. It's one of the things is just how long should this seed be that you want to do your initial alignment with. Another one is how many mismatches or how many differences do you allow between your read and the reference contig. There are going to be some differences due to sequencing errors. There's also potentially polymorphisms in there, and you don't want to throw out reads because they have true polymorphisms in there. So that's always a balance. How many do you allow while not allow? So you don't want to throw away too much data, but you also don't want to allow for too many mismatches. And then you can basically use your RNA-seq data in two different ways, or both. And you can look at gene expression changes. And this is just one very, very simple way you do it. It's by just counting the number of reads that align to each contig. So in this case, we have 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. And in this case, we have 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9. So that's an indirect measure of gene expression. And then by comparing the fraction of reads that match a contig between samples, we can basically get an idea of differential gene expression. And to do that, we just count our reads that match to a contig, and then we have to normalize it by basically how many reads we have for that sample in total. And so in this case, for example, we have 15 million reads total for this sample, and we have 7 reads that match this contig. In this sample number 2 here, we have 13 million reads total, and we have 9 reads that match that contig. So are they differentially expressed? Sort of. If you see, you have less reads here total, but you have more that match this contig. So that's one very, very simple example, of course. And there are a lot of quite sophisticated normalization methods to and parametric and non-parametric tests to look for differences in gene expression throughout the transcriptome. One thing to stress here is that it's very important to account for false positives, as we're comparing a lot of different things here. There's going to be quite a few that are different just by pure chance. So it's important to account for those. We can also look for functional enrichment. So that's one of the advantages of using transcriptomes. And this you can do actually both with expression data, but also with genotype data. You can see if your differentially expressed data set or your your FST outlier data set, for example, are enriched in certain functions. So here's just a quick example, just to show you how it works, is that if you have the entire transcriptome, you have 24,000 genes, you have 12,000 of those, or 1,200 of those, that are within this function, immunity, say, for example. Just in total, you have these many that are differentially expressed out of totally 24,000, sorry. But then if you look at just immune genes, you have 35 genes, 12 of those are differentially expressed. So you have a higher fraction within this data set than you do in the total. So that's basically one way you can increase your power, because here you can detect actually smaller changes over a lot of different genes. Whereas if you look at individual genes, a lot of times you can only detect large changes. One thing to think about, this is the same as with annotation, that you're using basically for function, you're basically stuck with using annotation that was created from vertebrates a lot of times. So if you're working with, say, snails, then a lot of times your genes are not going to have the same function. So that's really something you think about when you interpret your results. So one other way you can go with this, as we know, is to do a SNP detection and genotype your individuals from your RNA-seq reads. And basically the way it works is that it looks for consistent patterns of mismatches in your alignment. So basically when you have just one read with a difference here, it's likely to be a sequencing error. If you have in your individual a consistent pattern that about half of the reads has a G, whereas the other half has an A, then that could be a polymorphism. And actually, finding all of these mismatches is not that hard. The hard part is distinguishing between your true polymorphisms versus either sequencing errors or alignment artifacts. So you need to filter your data set. So you do an initial call set just to find everywhere in your transcriptome or genome where you have polymorphisms. And then you filter that to try to just save the ones that are likely to be true and not to be false positives. And there are a lot of different methods for this. We'll use one tomorrow called the Variant Quality Score Recalibrator that's implemented by the Genome Analysis Toolkit. But that's one way. And then once you have your SNP call set, you can genotype your individuals at all of these loci. And usually you get quality scores or probabilities for both for your SNP and for your individual genotypes out from the software that you use. And I'm not going to go into the models behind it anymore because they are opaque. And here, just one last slide, just what you can do once you have your genotypes. You can do a PCA, as I've said, to find population substructure. You can do outlier scans to find loci potentially under selection. And then one of the most, I think, widely used applications today, if you also have a phenotype, is that you can do these association studies where you basically find your loci that are associated with a certain trait in your organism of choice. And that's, as you know, that's, you know, there's almost every week there's an article in Nature doing this type of work. So that's what I wanted to talk about, the background a little bit, and we'll get into the smaller details later. Now I want to get into sort of two case studies, and one is to look at gene expression changes in corals and looking at the basis for thermal tolerance, And then the other one is to look at polymorphisms and genotyping abalone. So this first study is a work by Dan Barshes, which was done at Hopkins and co-authors. And basically what they wanted to understand was which genes or which physiological processes were involved in stress tolerance, and more specifically, which genes are involved in tolerance to thermal changes, and how are these different between tolerant and corals that are not tolerant. So they went out to this really, really neat site in the South Pacific, which is the island of Ofu, which is located right in the middle of nowhere. But it's extremely, extremely beautiful place, very pristine environment. And and this island is basically hourglass shaped, and it has a really nice fringe and barrier reef. They assigned certain sites to this island. So you have a four reef site, which basically is outside the slope, outside of the reef, where you have stable temperatures. It's basically the same conditions as the surrounding ocean, very small fluctuations. Then you have several different back reef pools of varying sizes. There's certain ones that are quite large, that see a lot of water exchange. And these have, but they are isolated at low tide. And especially when you have low tide during daytime, the water heats up in these pools. And then you have also smaller pools where you see much more heating during low tide. And so here are basically some temperature profiles where the blue line here is the four reef sites. As you see, it's fairly stable throughout the year. And then the green is the medium variability pool. You'll see there's a lot of fluctuations. And then in the red here is the high variability pool, the small pool. And you see that it varies a lot, and it even goes up, you know, above 34 degrees at some times during the year, which is really above the temperature where corals should bleach and die. But there are corals in this pool, so obviously they don't know that they're supposed to die. And so there was an initial study done by Tom Oliver as a first author, looking just at the tolerance of these corals from the different pools. And basically what this shows is you have a proportion of survivors here on the y-axis and over time. And the blue lines here are the control treatments. And the red ones here are the ones that were heated up. So they were heated up to, I think, 32 degrees or so. And the triangles here are the ones from the high variability pool, whereas the other ones were from the other locations. And the high variability pool ones, they did totally fine in heated environment, whereas the other ones did not do so well. So that was kind of a hint that there's something interesting going on here. And so they decided to do RNA sequencing of both tolerant corals and sensitive corals that had been exposed to stress. And just to define tolerant and susceptible corals, the tolerant ones were the ones found in this high variability pool with a higher stress tolerance, as shown by this previous experiment. And they're dominant in clade D symbionts. So all of the corals have symbionts, can be of different evolutionary origin. And then you have the susceptible corals that were living in this medium variability reef with a lower stress tolerance and another clade of symbionts. And they basically both were subjected to heat stress and also a control treatment for 3 days, and then the mRNA were sequenced from these individuals. A transcriptome was assembled, and then the reads were mapped or aligned to this newly created reference. And then finally, they did a differential expression analysis and compare the two groups. So just to look at the transcriptome at first, they basically use these, put 31 lanes of an Illumina machine with 16 control and 15 heated fragments from 15 individuals. So a good thing with corals is that they're clonal, so you can actually cut them apart and put one piece in stress and one in a control treatment. And this was about 500 million reads. And then they assembled this using a software called CLC Genomics Workbench and arrived at a transcriptome with about 220,000 contigs, which is a lot. But then you have to remember that there's a lot of stuff in corals. It's not just the coral. There's the symbionts, there's bacteria, there's fungi, a lot of things in there. So what they did then was to basically blast this against the cnidarian database and against the genome of a closely related species, and then also blasting against the symbiont database to remove contaminants. And they basically arrived at a list in the end of 33,500 putative genes. So that's quite a good genome, transcriptome, I would say. And about 70% of this was well annotated using these online databases. So what are the things that change in temperature stress? Well, we see that if you compare the tolerant ones and controls versus heated, there are about 160 that change. The blue ones are ones that go down under stress. The red ones are ones that go up. In susceptible, there's about 250. And there are 78 that are in common. So this would be sort of a common heat stress response. And so what are these that are in common? So here's just a list of the most differentially expressed ones. And so you have membrane components, you have ion homeostasis, DNA replication, and the list goes on and on. So that's one of the things you can sort of use this type of data for, is just to get a list of potential interesting genes. Another thing that they did that was kind of interesting was to look at, well, okay, now we know which ones they have in common, but which ones are different? So you have 81 that change here that don't change here, and 169 in the susceptible ones that don't change in the tolerant ones. So what do they do? And in particular, the ones that change in the susceptible corals but not in the tolerant ones, why don't we see them change in the tolerant ones? What are they doing in the tolerant ones? So you can plot these on a graph like this, where you basically have your twofold change on the x-axis in your susceptible corals, and then the fold change in tolerant corals on the y-axis. And say if your the ones that are changing in your susceptible corals are doing the opposite thing in tolerant corals, you would see a pattern like this, right? So things that go up here, they have a fourfold upregulation in the susceptible ones, they go down in the tolerant ones, and vice versa. So that's a pattern you would see in that case if they did the opposite thing. If they did the same thing in the tolerant corals, you would expect them to fall on this one-to-one line. And if they're just not doing anything in the tolerant corals, then you would expect them to just be off from this one-to-one line towards the zero here. So they're not changing at all, basically, or very little in the tolerant corals. And so what does the data show? Well, the data show that all these genes that are differentially expressed in susceptible ones have a reduced reaction in tolerant corals. So they're just reacting less. The ones that are downregulated in susceptible ones, they're also downregulated in tolerant ones, but to a much lower extent. And the same thing goes for upregulated ones. They just change less. And this is highly significant. And so that's kind of weird. Is it just that they just don't care? Or well, they did a plot like this to show what is happening here. So here you have ones that react less to heat intolerant corals. So here on this one-to-one line are ones that react about the same intolerant as in susceptible corals. And here below the one line here are the ones that react less to stress intolerant corals than in sensitive corals. And what you see is that a lot of these guys just have a higher expression level before they get stressed in the tolerant corals. So they're just upregulated even before they get stressed out. So they are like psychic corals. They just know that they're going to get stressed, so they're upregulated already. So the implications of this is that the fluctuating environment here increases resilience for these corals that live in that environment. And here they defined resilience as reduced reaction due to front loading. So basically the corals that live in this environment, they keep their genes on basically all the time to a larger extent. So there's this pre-stress difference. And that shows that there's a functional diversity here from gene to physiology to evolution. And that's on a single reef scale. So you have to remember that these pools are right next to each other and there's gene flow going on between them. So the second case study I want to talk about is about polymorphisms in red abalone and how we can use that to look at gene flow and to also look at patterns of natural selection. And so I want to just introduce you to red abalone because that's my kind of favorite animal right now, except for oysters because that's what I work with now. It's a large marine snail. They get to be about this big if you are not familiar with them. Locally, they're economically important in California. They are not doing so well, the abalone in California. They're under threat. Importantly, they have a kind of short larval phase, so there's a very limited potential for dispersal. But there's been several previous studies that have not found any population structure. So you have this sort of weird mystery that you have a patchy habitat of California kelp forests where the abalone live, and they don't really disperse that well. So you would expect there to be some sort of population structure. Yet there's been two different studies that have not been able to detect any population structure. So one of the questions we wanted to look at was if we can use an increased number of genetic markers to find any potential population structure in there, or is there just no structure for some reason? The other aspect of this was to look at the effects of environmental change. So as we all know, global temperatures are going up. We have occurrences of coastal hypoxia that are going up. And we also have oceanic pH, which is going down. And all of this is potential for stress on these, or potential for causing selection in these animals. But that's going to happen in the future. But already today, there are certain places where you see very, very large variations in all of these parameters. And California is such a place where you have this very heterogeneous landscape, where you have upwelling of this deep water that's very low in oxygen and low in pH in some locations, but not in others. So here's the California coast, and here's the border here between California and Oregon. And right here in Northern California, there's a region that at least periodically experiences upwelling of water that's very, very low in pH. You also have a temperature gradient from north to south that's a little bit complicated by upwelling conditions. And finally, you also have differential disease pressures. So you have this one disease called withering foot syndrome that's lethal to abalone that's only been recorded up to the mouth of San Francisco Bay, which is here. So only in Southern California, but not in the northern part. So a lot of potential things going on here. And one question that we wanted to look at was if we can find some genes that exhibit signs of local adaptation that we could correlate to these environmental differences. This is also exploratory study to try to find some candidate genes. So we went out and we collected abalone in Northern California up in this red zone in Sonoma and in Monterey, just outside of Hopkins Marine Station. And we did 7 lanes of Illumina sequencing, so about 500 million bases. And then we did a de novo transcriptome assembly, which resulted in about 163,000 contigs, which is also, as with corals, that's a high number. But when we annotate it, we can annotate about 48,000 contigs. And if we just count the ones that, if we count the number of unique hits in databases that these contigs have, we arrive at a list of about 22,000 genes. So yeah, 5 minutes should be fine. We have about a little over 60% of the reads that align to our transcriptome. And when we plug this into a SNP detection pipeline, we find almost 1.2 million SNP sites in our transcriptome, which ends up being about 1.4% of the entire transcriptome, which is quite a high number, I would say. If we weed this down to only sites that have high-quality genotype for all individuals, we end up with a list of about 21,600 SNPs. And then to look at population structure, we did a principal components analysis. And we get this result. So as you can see, they are not really substructuring at all. So from this data, we really can't say anything about population structure here. And just to look at the mean FST throughout all the sites, it's very, very close to zero, which as you might know, FST ranges between zero and one, where zero is just completely homogeneous. But when we look at individual SNP sites, we see that there's a huge variation in FSTs. And this is just a plot from one of these softwares called Locitan, where it basically plots a confidence interval from all of the SNP sites, and then it finds the loci that are above the confidence interval. And it finds about 680 SNPs that are outside of the confidence interval. And if we just weed that down to the ones that are in annotated genes, so we know what they do, and also look at ones that only have more than one outlier SNP in one gene, just to try to get rid of any false positives, we end up with a list of 34 genes. And so I'm not going to talk about all of them, because then Matt would come and get me. But I just want to mention a few. So one that pops up really quickly is this gene called PIF. It's known to bind aragonite into the shell matrix. And it's key in nacre formation in oysters. And aragonite is a form of calcium carbonate, which is highly, highly sensitive to changes in pH. And this gene is different in allele frequency in Northern California compared to these two more southern sites. And there's five SNPs in there, and they are all coding. Another function that pops up is ATP metabolism. So you have both ATP synthase and ATPase are different in Northern California as well. Just to relate this to literature, you have inurchins. They've seen that ATP synthase is upregulated in response to ocean acidification settings. And in oysters, they've also seen that ATP levels in the mantle decrease under high CO2 stress, which makes sense because they need to maintain homeostasis inside their bodies. So they have to spend energy to pump their ions out of their tissues. And finally, you have this gene, the sodium glucose cotransporter, which is known in oysters to be involved in tolerance to pathogens during warm temperatures. And in our data set, it's different in Southern California compared to the two more northern sites. And that can be correlated with this disease, the withering foot syndrome. So to conclude here from this, we can corroborate previous studies that we cannot see any population structure in California. But we do find a set of genes that are more divergent than expected. And these genes have been implicated in other organisms as being affected by several of these environmental parameters. And so these are excellent candidates for further studies. So that's where I want to end. So thank you.
So we have 20 minutes before lunch, and there's probably most immediately some questions from Pierre, but the idea was here, since the things that we're talking about this morning all interact, that this is time for talking about those interactions, those trade-offs. So feel free to ask a question that may or, you know, deal with anything for this morning. And in fact, I want to introduce Nancy Chen, who I haven't spoken yet, but who's another instructor here, so that get all the introductions out. I think we don't really have a panel table, just to make it challenging for the videographer. We'll just do the best we can and see what happens in terms of questions. And maybe pass around this mic to, is there a handheld that feeds?
I do not, please.
Okay. The floor is open.
Getting back to this question of experimental design, specifically with trying to get at that transcriptome gene expression, in organisms that don't necessarily work in a laboratory environment, like I'm picking trees, like, you can't do transgeneration, you can't breed them. They reach maturity after 30 years. Like, we'll be dead in two generations of a single tree. So how do you try to apply these types of methods to organisms that don't lend themselves to the traditional design that Drosophila or mice models use?
It's tricky. Well, I think the stage that we're at with a lot of these organisms is that we can't really do what they do with Drosophila, right? So we kind of have to make do with what we can do and try to common garden things for as long as possible and hope for the best, pretty much. And I think to think at this stage that we can do perfect experiments that, you know, discount for all potential sources of error, I don't think that's realistic that we can do that right now. So we just have to kind of hope for the best.
You're willing to accept uncertainty?
Yes, or maybe the botanist has a good answer.
I guess, since I know you work on cottonwoods, I think, I mean, you have the advantages that you have clonal propagation. And so you don't need to wait for multiple generations. People do transcriptomics in cottonwoods all the time, and development and physiology and all these things. And one way you should think about transcriptome as a phenotype, and that in the context of quantitative genetics, we've been doing that for a long time, studying phenotypes that might have maternal effects or carryover effects between generations. And so you have to do the best you can do. It's not a special problem for transcriptomics and studying phenotypes. The transcript.
Yeah, I was asking less specifically for myself, but I know there's people working on organisms that don't lend themselves to some of these designs.
Yeah, and as you saw with the coral study, it's a bit the same thing. They have extremely long-lived organisms. They live for 5,000-10,000 years, and you know, you just make do, and you. But like Alex said, because they're clonal organisms, you can also basically, you know, take different parts of the same organism, expose them to different treatments.
But there are real constraints with different taxa, right? You can't do everything with each of taxa. So it's, you ask the questions you can with the taxon you can. Or if you're not bound to a specific taxon, and you're interested in a question, then you find the taxon that's best for that question, right? Which depends on. So Laura?
So thinking about the expression data and analyzing expression data, what do you think would be the impact instead of marking individuals and looking at the expression of individuals, to pulling individuals and looking at the expression of the whole pool? Do you think there are complications in analysis with that, or anything that you should be aware of if a particular individual perhaps overexpresses a bit of a student of pool?
Did everybody hear that?
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So the question was, what would be complications of doing gene expression studies on basically a pool of individuals, so rather than sequencing each individual separately? I think the most pressing thing is the issue of allele-specific expression. But I mean, that also goes if you sequence individuals. Just off of my head, I think it can be more of an issue, perhaps. Well, maybe not, if you sequence pools.
But I'm not worried if you're not looking at nucleotide sequence, but actually looking at expression differences between populations, for example, between treatments, mm-hmm. whether they need to share pool versus part of the nucleotide.
Well, I think that a little specific expression could be a problem if you have also have allele frequency differences between your two treatments, and those alleles are also differently expressed, and that could definitely cause a lot of problems. That's what I can think of off the top of my head. But I know people do pooled analyses of gene expression.
Good. You have a question?
Partially answered.
Okay.
I guess more traditionally, when we were trying to amplify mitochondrial DNA, people were really concerned about amplifying the nuclear column. And I guess has anybody thought about the effect of probably mitochondrial DNA contamination and how that would look, for example, in an FSC outlier analysis, where you would have presumably higher FSC with smaller
version
size. Does anybody address that?
Well, usually you can separate out your mitochondrial DNA fairly easily from your nuclear DNA. First of all, your mitochondrial genes are usually fairly easy to annotate. So if you do transcriptomes, a lot of times you'll find them, and then you can kind of put them aside. If you can't do that, you can also, mitochondrial genome a lot of times has a different GC content, so you can actually use GC content a lot of times to separate things out. That's what we're you're doing in this genome project. We're actually quite easily can throw out everything that's bacterial and mitochondrial, because it shows up as, if you plot GC content, they'll pop out as separate islands, sort of, that you can just get rid of.
Question back here.
When you're doing RNA-seq studies on expression, gene expression, especially when you're extracting RNA from whole organism, and you don't really know what's going to be over or under stress, is there a problem of maybe the genes that you're interested in, they are expressed at such low levels that you can't detect compared to all the stuff that is highly expressed? Mm-hmm. Is that a problem that people run into?
Yeah, absolutely. I think one of the main issues with this is that you do have to throw out a lot of data. And as you saw in these the abalone study, we're getting a lot of data, and most of it, 90% of it, we have to throw away. And a lot of times, things that are lowly expressed in a tissue will also just be discarded, because you cannot. When you have certain genes that are, 2,000 copies in one individual and 10,000 in another, then your power to detect differential gene expression between something that has one transcript versus two, you just don't have power to detect that. So yeah, you do a lot of times end up looking at things that are highly expressed in a tissue.
In that respect, do you recommend normalization if you're not so much interested in gene expression, but finding a certain transcript to normalize libraries?
I don't think so for gene expression.
I mean, if you're not interested in gene expression.
If you're not interested in gene expression, then
genes?
Yeah, if you're not interested in gene expression, there's certainly the possibility of using normalized libraries to account for differences in coverage. That is very possible. And that's something you just have to think about when you design your experiment, that if you're totally not interested in gene expression at all, then yeah, normalization is certainly a good way to go.
I haven't seen it done, maybe just because normalization is a pain.
Yeah, and there's not so many people that use transcriptomes for.
Everybody wants to look at genotyping. Right?
Yeah,
they people want to throw that out, that possibility.
Yeah.
Well, I thought
yeah.
some people will make the transcriptomes as like reference transcriptomes summary using the normalized library, and then we'll collect non normalized library to create a good expression. That I see.
Yeah.
This is a question more broadly about how outlier loans that work, but so like the example you had out of your million or so SNPs, 600 were outliers. Like how is that outlier defined or found? Like percent cutoff.
So I thought Alex had a really nice figure showing that. Basically, you're plotting the distribution of FSTs at all of your loci in your study. And from that distribution, you can get a 95% confidence interval. And then you basically define your outliers as whatever is, you know, above your confidence interval. And you can set, you know, what confidence interval you want to have individually. So it's so if you do an outlier study, basically, a lot of times you will find some outliers because, you know, there's always a few loci that are outside of your confidence interval. So then the next step is to sort of try to understand how what are these do and are any of these likely. You also need to know the biology of the system because to evaluate what your outliers actually are. Does that answer?
I wouldn't mind saying there are very different ways of quantifying the variation amongst your loci or whatever you're looking at. And one major distinction is between just looking at your empirical distribution of values and saying that I'm going to look at my top 2.5% and my bottom 2.5%, whatever those are. And that's just using an empirical distribution. And you will always have 2.5% of your things falling in one tail, 2.5. I mean, that's what the curve would be if we ever imposed it in a class. Because there will be people at the end, and people will get X. But we don't really do that. Instead, an alternative to using an empirical distribution is using a parametric distribution. And so if you're estimating a parameter and its variant, it is not necessarily true that you will have outliers in that case.
Deb?
This is for any of the speakers this morning. Are there any special considerations or things one should think about before attempting to do any of these techniques in polyploid organisms? I'm thinking the genome size would be much larger, might be more repetitive sequence. I don't know.
Well, so a lot of the tools are set up for diploids,
right?
A lot of this was designed for humans. Where there can only be very often two allele states at a SNP. And the problem is, it depends very much on how ancient the polyploid is and how easily you'll be able to distinguish allelic copies from paralogs.
Right.
And so it's a special problem for assembly. But if you have fairly ancient, I mean, all organisms are actually, lots of organisms are ancient polyploids. And so we deal with this at some level already. But it just happens to be the polyploid event so long ago that it's fairly easy to set a criterion for saying, I'm going to continue to assemble onto this, I'm going to tolerate a certain mismatch, and I'm going to call that allele, versus breaking things up. It's totally possible, but it's a lot of it has not been done that successfully. Of course, the models that I was talking about for doing allele frequency estimation, that type of thing, if you really do have four allele copies, and your multinomial is, you know, four draws from those allele copies, you can do that.
Right.
There isn't a lot of software that's written for it, and there's always people who are interested in polyploids.
Yeah, even for microsats, there's not a lot.
But it's totally feasible, and it's the same map.
Papers that have warned how much that bias can affect inference on a population parameter. curious if, what the possibility is of sort of modeling that bias and accounting for it in some ways.
I'm glad you brought that up because in the hallway we were talking about the risk of, from my perspective, since I work on high heterozygosity organisms, I'm like, this sucks. So there's a couple dimensions to this. There's a lot of organisms with relatively low heterozygosity where this is a very subtle effect. There's also the ability to filter it out because where you have null alleles, you're going to have a missing data. You're going to have null homozygotes. And so just cover those loci out. And so there's a lot of potential for filtering it out. Nonetheless, that could still leave, you know, biased data sets that are going to matter for some questions and not others. So how would you approach the specific question about modeling?
And so do you mean modeling how likely the problem is like, how much of a problem is likely to exist in different organisms with different heterozygosities? Or do you mean modeling, given I have an organism, I'm stuck with it, how am I going to have a good analogy?
Yeah, I could at least envision the possibility of basically accounting for the bias in the statistical model that you apply to try to defer the population parameters. Say, I know my observation is biased, but then you have an observation model on top of your genetic population model.
Yeah, and so these models that account for genotype uncertainty, you could explicitly incorporate it in there. And people have done that before with microsatellites where they were accounting for the possibility of null alleles. And so they were doing population structure inference based on the microsatellites, but there could have been no alleles as well. That part is possible. Modeling the likelihood that it's going to affect your organism was done in a paper fairly recently that came out in a special issue of Molecular Ecology on Genotyping by Sequencing. I think it's worth looking at that paper really carefully thinking about whether the concern applies to your organism or not. Because for organisms that are not particularly heterozygous, which in my experience has been most of them that I've worked with, including outcrossing trees, we're not particularly concerned about it, particularly because of the filtering steps that we impose where we drop loci where there's a substantial amount of missing data. Also, that model depends very much the extent to which missing data can be a problem depends a lot on how much linkage disequilibrium there is between the restriction site and your SNP. And so that will depend on the linkage disequilibrium in your organism, which we typically don't know. But like I saw, at least in the mammals, there was high heterogeneity in terms of parameters that are next to one another within a contig. And so I'm not that concerned. And so that you might still pick up that allelic state in different backgrounds with or without the restriction cycle.
I guess the concern with filtering would be that, if you are filtering out the places that are polymorphic for the restriction cycle, you might also be filtering out all the tags that would be polymorphic.
The most highly, yeah.
Yeah, if there's enough linkage or mutation is varying.
Yeah,
and
I think that's a totally valid concern, but I think in any of the methods that we're talking about, even whole genome resequencing, you are biased towards a particular fraction of the genome. If you're doing whole genome resequencing, you're biased towards the fraction of the genome that could be assembled, because none of the genomes are finished. I don't know if you noticed in the human chromosome on chromosome 1, that big gap in the middle, that's where we don't know what's there, or we know stuff is there and it's this big, roughly. But we don't know the sequence. And that's just going to be worse than all other organisms. So even whole genome sequencing, it's enriched for gene space and the stuff that's low copy number and has a particular characteristic that makes it assembled. So we have trade-offs there, too. So you shouldn't, I don't feel so bad.
But it's important to be aware of those trade-offs, right? It's important to be aware of if you've got assembly artifacts,
one more thing I think that's worth saying about that, because I mean we don't want to be biased. That's one of the worst things you can say about it. But I think it's important to think through the next steps that, okay, yes, I've missed, there are null alleles, I've messed something up. But it's important to think about the downstream consequences of that in terms of analysis, and how is that going to affect inference? And that's not necessary. Just because you've done something biased in terms of estimation does not mean that everything is wrong. Because it might not affect population structure, because you wouldn't necessarily think that you have more bias in one situation than another. You could, but it's not always going to.